That's funny you should mention Tchaikovsky, because I was just thinking about concertos in general yesterday and how some concertos, the soloist role is very clear, like in Tchaikovsky or, for example, in Schoenberg, where the composer takes away 80% of the orchestra whenever the soloist is playing. Bryce sort of does the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really more of a sort of boxing match.
Und damit danke fürs Einschalten und herzlich willkommen zum Elbphilharmonie Talk. Mein Name ist Julika.
Ich bin Tom.
Und Tom, für diese Folge hast du ja mit dem finnischen Musiker Pekka Kuusisto gesprochen. Wir haben eben schon kurz diskutiert, weil ich vorgeschlagen hatte, ihn als Allround-Musiker anzumoderieren. Und da hast du vehement widersprochen.
Ja, also ihn als Allround-Musiker zu bezeichnen, fand ich ein bisschen, weil meine Vorstellung von Allround ist, ich kann eigentlich alles, aber ich kann nichts so richtig gut.
Also Allround-Musiker fast noch als Untertreibung für ihn.
Ja, weil Allround vielleicht auch nicht, aber er kann viele Dinge, die eigentlich normalerweise ein Spitzengeiger auf dem Niveau nicht alle können muss. Und er kann sie einfach auch alle wirklich sehr, sehr gut. Ne? Er macht ja sehr viel Folkmusik auch und er macht mit Elektronik rum und hat jetzt ein neues Projekt mit dem Gabriel Cahain, der auch ein E-Musiker ist und ein Singer-Songwriter, wo ziemlich tolles Zeug bei rauskommt.
Ja, das ist so eher in Richtung Pop dann, ne?
Ja, aber Pop für Erwachsene, würde ich schon sagen. Also
Dirigent ist er dann eben auch noch, stand auch auf der Elbphilharmonie-Bühne schon als Dirigent. Also wir hatten ja auch schon im Talk mit Riccardo Minasi verschiedene Menschen, die eben von der Geige her kommen, dann Dirigentinnen geworden sind. In diesem Fall, er macht wirklich beides.
Ja, er macht beides und trotzdem ist er natürlich, glaube ich, immer noch in erster Linie Geiger. Aber er macht das gerne und er erzählt sehr schön, wie er das Dirigieren dann doch ein bisschen auch akademisch gelernt hat, ohne dass er je offiziell Dirigieren studiert hätte. Das ist eher so anekdotisch, dass er sagt, es gab immer, glaube ich, am Samstagmorgen in der Sibelius-Akademie in Helsinki, gab es die Dirigierkonzerte, die Proben für Dirigierstudenten. Und am Freitagabend davor ging man immer feiern und er war auch immer mit feiern. Und manche der Dirigierstudenten hatten aber so hart gefeiert, dass sie irgendwann so mittendrin, so nach dem siebten Wodka vielleicht, dann sagten, kannst du morgen für mich einspringen? Und er hat das dann gerne gemacht, weil er offenbar etwas moderater getrunken hat. Und dann hat er auf diese Weise dann noch eine ganze Menge sozusagen auch Erfahrung haben können schon und sammeln können in der Zeit in der Akademie. Und das fand ich ganz interessant, weil die finnischen Dirigenten sind ja Legende. Die haben einfach dadurch, dass sie so eine tolle
Zumindest
Ausbildung
die, die
haben.
Den Freitagabend immer überlebt
die
haben.
Die den Freitagabend überleben bei gesunder Leber. Die sind irgendwie ja überproportional viele junge, tolle Dirigenten auf den Podien der Welt unterwegs. Das muss man einfach immer wieder mit Erstaunen und Hochachtung feststellen.
Wie war er denn so im Gespräch?
Ich fand ihn ganz zauberhaft. Er war sehr offen. Er war witzig, er war reflektiert und sehr menschlich.
Ihr seid auch zu ziemlich persönlichen Themen gekommen.
Ja, ja, wir haben viel über Persönliches gesprochen, was bei ihm nahe liegt, weil er ganz eng mit seinem Bruder Jaakko Kuusisto verbunden war, der vor 2 Jahren gestorben ist an einem beschissenen, blöden Hirntumor. Und in relativ kurzer Zeit auch. Und die haben zusammen studiert, die waren zusammen in den USA und haben da irgendwie auch noch mehrere Jahre Geigenstudium gehabt und waren einander wirklich auch sehr nah. Und das ist einfach eine Tragödie, weil er war jung. Meine Pekka ist Jahrgang 76, der Bruder ist 2 Jahre älter. Und was das auch macht mit so jemandem, eigentlich in full flight of career, dass da plötzlich der Bruder weg ist, das beschäftigt mich auch selber als Familienmensch natürlich. Und das war sehr schön, wie er darüber gesprochen hat. Es ist zum Glück lang genug her, dass ich überhaupt gewagt habe, das anzusprechen, weil sonst hat man das Gefühl, das ist so roh und so wund, da will man noch gar nicht rangehen. Es war schwer genug, aber es war dann auch gut. Und ich hatte auch das Gefühl, er will auch bis zum gewissen Grad darüber sprechen, weil er einfach das ja auf eine gute Weise
das irgendwie... Das macht ihn auch aus.
Macht ihn aus, ja. Es gehört zu seinem Leben dazu. Und er hat sehr früh schon immer gesagt, ja, das ist alles sehr vorübergehend, was wir hier so erleben auf der Welt. Keiner weiß, wie lange das dauert.
Ihr habt euch ja am Silvestermorgen getroffen, kurz bevor ihr hier zweifach, also am 31. und dann auch am 1.1. eben im Silvesterkonzert mit dem NDR Elbphilharmonie Orchester auf der Bühne stand. Da hatte er ein ziemlich toughes Werk vor sich.
Ja, da hat er mal wieder das Violinkonzert von Bryce Dessner gespielt, was eine Tour de force par excellence ist. Er war lange der Einzige, ist ja witzig, weil es gibt es erst seit 2 Jahren, glaube ich, das Stück. Er hat es richtig oft schon gespielt, weil Bryce Dessner ist außerordentlich erfolgreich, Gitarrist von The National, wie man weiß, und sehr etabliert inzwischen als Komponist von zeitgenössischer Musik für Orchester und für kleinere Ensembles und Streichquartette und alles. Und die kennen einander sehr lange und sehr gut. Und das Stück ist für Becker geschrieben.
Die haben sich in Hamburg kennengelernt.
Die haben sich in Hamburg im Stadtpark kennengelernt bei einem Konzert von The National, wo Nico Muhly eingefädelt hatte, dass die sich kennenlernen. Auch ein berühmter amerikanischer zeitgenössischer Komponist. Und haben viel Gefallen ineinander gefunden. Und eben diese Mehrgleisigkeit zwischen Tschaikowski spielen können, Violinkonzert und eben Singer-Songwriter-Musik machen und zeitgenössische Musik ganz ernst nehmen, aber auch auf so einem vitalen Niveau spielen wollen, kommunizieren wollen mit jedem Takt, den man spielt, da sind die einander, glaube ich, sehr, sehr ähnlich und seelenverwandt möglicherweise.
Vitales Niveau heißt in diesem Fall ja wirklich richtig sportlich auch, ja, ne? Du spielst, ich das auch, richtig verstanden.
Ja, wir haben lange über die technischen, also zum Teil über die technischen Details dieses Stücks gesprochen, aber vor allem einfach auch über die Konditionsanforderungen, die dieser Solopart an den Solisten stellt. Gute halbe Stunde muss der eigentlich fast durchgehend ackern und schuften und geigen und machen und in hohem Tempo sehr exakt spielen. Und das Ganze geht mit einer Bogentechnik einher, die man auch erstmal haben muss. Und er beschreibt sehr anschaulich, wie er sich diesem Werk physisch anverwandelt hat im Laufe der Zeit.
Heißt wirklich Workout.
Heißt Liegestützen machen vorm Konzert, vor allen Dingen am Anfang. Er hat neue Techniken jetzt entwickelt, die ihm das, glaube ich, ersparen. Aber er hat am Anfang gedacht, wenn ich jetzt nicht irgendwie mich so pump it up mäßig hinstelle, dann schaffe ich das gar nicht. Inzwischen macht er Pilates seit einem Jahr. Das ist, wie man weiß, eine wunderbare Körperpraxis, die innere Core-Muskulatur stärkt. Das heißt, man holt Kraft von woanders her, als man sie vielleicht sonst holt.
Und das alles in dieses kleine Instrument.
Und in diesen ja auch nicht furchtbar großen, massiven Mann. Also muss man einfach auch sagen, ne? Das ist kein sehr großer, hochgewachsener, bulliger, stämmiger Geiger. Da gibt's andere Formate.
Wir müssen vielleicht der Vollständigkeit halber sagen, dass das Werk wirklich nicht nur eine sportliche Übung ist, sondern einfach auch zum Zuhören unfassbar packend und toll.
Ein scharfes Stück Musik, würde ich sagen. Und das ist auch vom Orchester her sehr viel gefordert und verlangt. Und Pecker beschrieb das so schön. Ja, bei Schönberg ist es so, Schönberg lässt immer das Orchester ganz wenig machen in dem Moment, wo die Solostimme von der Geige kommt. Und Bryce macht's genau umgekehrt. Es ist ja die ganze Zeit Geige und das Orchester ackert auch wie blöde. Und da kommt natürlich unheimlich viel Impuls. Und da sich sozusagen zu behaupten und gleichzeitig eben auch zu akzeptieren, dass man manchmal vielleicht einfach überschwemmt wird von der Welle, weil das auch so viel Wassermetaphern gibt in diesem Stück. Das ist einfach auch eine Chiffre für Individuum, Gesellschaft, Kollektiv, der Einzelne. Da passiert ganz viel, wo man ins Nachdenken kommen kann bei diesem Stück,
finde ich. Wer sich das nochmal angucken möchte, anhören möchte, kann das übrigens in der Elbphilharmonie-Mediathek tun. Da gibt es noch den Konzertstream von Silvester verfügbar. Den Link packen wir euch auch auf jeden Fall in die Shownotes.
Ja, das muss man gesehen und gehört haben, auf jeden Fall.
Ansonsten würde ich sagen, viel Spaß beim Zuhören.
Ja, bitte. Habt viel Freude.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
So wonderful sitting here with Pekka Kuu, who is still the Finnish violinist.
Thank you for that pronunciation.
Yes, on the New Year's Eve. And I wish I could pronounce it properly, because I know the Pekka is like the most difficult part for every German. The double consonants.
The double consonants, yeah. Yeah, but you don't need to rearticulate the second K. It's Pekka. Just a long K.
It's long, yeah, even but the long K Becca. In itself, Becca.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's very good. Very, very good.
Becca, you are here for the, I would even say the umpteenth time, because you have really played a lot already in this hall in the few years of its existence.
Never enough.
And you've been playing in Hamburg so many times before. I remember you were one of the stalwarts in the Rantakalla Festival, like 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
Something like that. It's
very long ago.
Terribly long time ago.
And it was wonderful. And I think you played in the Pauli Theater in a very small venue. And
yeah, we played in a theater with Ensemble Resonance.
Exactly.
And there was a number of other things. The one I remember very clearly was at Übel Ungefährlich.
Yes.
There was a Finnish drum and bass DJ called Desto. And I played with him. I was kind of his warm-up act.
Okay.
And it was when James Blake had first come out with, he did a cover of the Feist song, Limit to Your Love. And I think Desto was one of the first people in Hamburg to play it for for a dancing audience. At Übel und Gefährlich. And it's such a good club for bass.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. It's very dry and very powerful.
We went crazy. And then the Finnish accordionist Kimmo Pohjonen had played in Kampnagel that same night with a group of Finnish wrestlers. He had a concert with actual wrestling.
Yeah.
Because there was a tradition in Finland to play accordion at wrestling matches to hide the farting noises. So, of course, Kimmo made a project out of it. And then all the wrestlers and Kimmo came to our backstage and started throwing each other around. And at the end, all the wrestlers piled up on top of Kimmo Pohjonen.
During your performance or afterwards?
Afterwards. Just in the release of all the adrenaline, they just needed to go and lie on top of Kimmo Pohjonen.
Poor guy, even though he's a sturdy man.
He's a sturdy man, and I think he loved it. I think it was a part of the ritual. But it was a really good time, and I don't think I've ever met so many Finnish musicians in one place as in Hamburg back then.
In this festival, during this. And that was way before the opening of the Elbphilharmonie. It must have been 5 to 6 years prior to this, or even more.
Yeah.
But ever since, you've been coming back and playing here and performing all sorts of music. And tonight, you are going to play the violin concerto of Bryce Dessner's, which you have already played in this hall once before, by the end of COVID, like mid-22, I think.
Do you think so?
Yes. With the, I think, which was the orchestra. I think you played it here. And with the drummer who became conductor.
Santtu,
yes.
Santtu and Philharmonia.
I think it was Philharmonia. Maybe it wasn't Philharmonia. Maybe it was Hessischer Rundfunk or someone else.
We will have to check this because I'm not sure that happened.
I think it has happened. I think I have even witnessed the concert and I was quite impressed with it.
So it was not Daniel Bjarnason concerto?
No. It was Bryce's. It was Bryce's.
Oh my goodness.
And it's in the list of his performances,
That's crazy.
And I mean, you have played it everywhere already, but this was maybe the fifth or sixth or seventh performance.
I haven't played it enough to forget about such an important... Because, you know, I actually met Bryce for the first time in Hamburg.
Oh, really?
Yeah, many, many, many years ago when his rock band, The National, were not quite as big as they are today. They played a show in Volkspark, like 1,500 people, something like that, came to the show. And
Volkspark is outdoor. Was it really outdoor?
It was outdoor, yeah. Oh, okay. But it was like not...
Stadtpark, probably. Stadtpark rather than Volkspark. Volkspark is the football stadium, which is massive.
Okay, then you're right, yeah. Sorry, my memory is not...
A green surrounding...
Exactly, like, so that was Stadtpark. Yeah, Stadtpark.
During the summertime, then.
Yeah, he played. I came specifically with two friends from Finland because we liked the band so much.
Oh, yeah.
And then our mutual friend Nico had arranged for me to get to meet Bryce. And that's where we hung out for the first time.
Oh, cool. So that's the initial starting point for all that would be coming afterwards.
Exactly. And Niels Hansen from this organization, from Elbphilharmonie, was there as well. I think he was a part of the arrangements for that concert. And yeah, so I think we are still feeling the reverberations of that one rock show.
Incredible. Yeah, Bryce was coming here in 2017. I think he was the first guest of what we would call Elbphilharmonie Reflektor, you know, like a festival, and he brought The National in the Grand Hall.
Of course,
Which was quite an endeavor, I can tell you. Yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah, I've seen that there's another rock band that are friends of mine, the Efterklang, from Denmark.
Yeah.
And I've seen that they've played in the big hall at least once, maybe even...
They have played once within the framework of Reeperbahn Festival, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So and they always do like 2 days program in here, and that was part of...
Nice.
...of the festival.
Nice.
Yeah, there have quite some rock musicians and some legends have been playing in this hall.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah. It's so nice that the hall has that kind of identity.
Yeah.
And it's also very visible to the rest of the world that this is a concert hall where... You know, everything can happen.
Yeah.
And will happen.
And it transforms sometimes, you know, the concept of people who perform there because they see the hall and then they say, oh, let's do something different than what we usually do.
Exactly.
Because it's so intriguing, you know, to play with the acoustics, to play with the possibilities of going on the stage and leaving the stage and all that stuff.
Yeah. No, I remember I was watching a film of, I think it was Stargaze. Under the Ridders group,
working with
I think it was like Erlend Oye, that's Norwegian, the guy, one of the kings of
Convenience.
Yeah. And there was something where I think it almost looked like kids in a candy store when the musicians were kind of discovering how to play the hall.
Yeah.
And just kind of, you know, living within the sound that they were making and just being ecstatic about it.
Yeah.
And it really needs a space like this for that to happen.
Totally. It has totally transformed the city meanwhile, which is also very good, of course. So, but then this violin concerto, which you don't remember having played in Hamburg a couple of years ago. You have played it many, many times in many different continents, meanwhile, at least in the US and in many beautiful venues in Europe. I think maybe 20 times, meanwhile.
Something like that, yeah.
How does it feel? Does it feel like the Tchaikovsky, meanwhile, for you, like so familiar with it? Or
that's funny you should mention Tchaikovsky, because I was just thinking about concertos in general yesterday and how some concertos, the soloist role is very clear, like in Tchaikovsky or, for example, in Schoenberg, where the composer takes away 80% of the orchestra whenever the soloist is playing. Bryce sort of does the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really more of a sort of boxing match.
Totally.
I remember the first couple of times I played the concerto, I really had to, because it's really quite heavy. There's a lot to do. And it's relentless. So I had to kind of warm up myself beforehand in a different way than I would for any other piece, just because of the physical nature of it. Because you have to be very flexible and relaxed in your hands and fingers. Mm-hmm. But I found I needed like an extra adrenaline. So I would literally do push-ups backstage before going on stage to play this concerto. Afterwards, I think I've gotten a little bit better at judging the amount of energy I invest in the different
and
parts
of
the...
And how to divide the energy during the concert. This is like a 22 minute...
It's a bit longer than
that.
I think it's nearly half an hour. And of the cadenza, Bryce has allowed me to improvise completely. So that might change the duration of the piece quite dramatically if I have a really fruitful night.
Cadenza is between the first and the second movement, right?
It's kind of towards the end of the first.
Yeah.
There's still a little kind of epilogue to the first movement. The first movement is most of the piece.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you say that, because I was wondering, and I wanted to ask you specifically, are you doing push-ups before? How are you lifting weights, you know, the week before you go on stage for doing the Bryce piece? Because I remember very vividly how utterly demanding it was, just in terms of sheer stamina and force and knowing that you are such a delicate player. You know, you can be so subtle and so you can say so much with so little volume that I felt, well, for you, it must maybe be even specifically difficult to go on the other side of dynamics all the time.
The thing that makes it easier for me, I think, is that I play a lot of traditional music and folk music.
Which is a little more hands-on kind of.
Yeah, it's kind of a slightly more robust, but also a very relaxed style of playing. So if you take one note from the Brahms concerto and multiply that by 6,000 and make that the Bryce concerto, then you will run out of energy. But if you take one note from a bluegrass fiddle player, then you can basically go on forever. It's about finding just the right amount of bow, how many centimeters per note, where does the pressure on the bow come from? Yeah. If you do it just from your fingers or from your wrist, you're going to wear yourself out. If you can use the weight of the hand, kind of just use your fingers for articulation, use your arm for weight, and then try to change gradually where your balance is in the body. So sometimes try to play from your feet, try to play from your lower back, these kind of things. I started studying Pilates properly about a year ago.
Good.
That has helped a lot with this kind of thing.
Because it gives all the core muscles more strength and it anchors the body.
Exactly, and I can sort of drop my shoulders while I'm playing, so I don't stay tense ever for very long times. But what I do is, actually, a couple of days ago would have been the 100th birthday of a very long-term Finnish violin teacher of mine. He passed away last January at the age of 99.
Wow.
And basically all of what I do with my bow comes from him. He studied in Paris in the mid-1900s. His name was Tuomas Haapanen, and he studied with a guy called Leon Novank, and Novank specialized in bow control. So I have about 48 different bow exercises from my teacher that I still do many of them on a daily basis. But whenever Bryce's concerto is approaching, I change the speed and the volume of them dramatically up. So I do a lot more repetitions. I do them a lot faster. So basically going from being a marathon runner to a 100 meter sprint runner kind of thing, and then just add repetitions. So you become like a sort of long-term sprinter in a way. And it takes a couple of weeks for the hands to adjust to that. And, you know, to be able to play relaxed with the left hand while working really fast and hard with the right hand. But it's actually a really useful skill to have figured out, because then it also makes some of the other repertoire a little bit simpler.
I totally believe this. Yeah. Now, you have been performing, I think the 10 first performances were all yours, and then there was Marie Samuelson coming and playing the piece for one. Is that true, or is it still always you?
It's not. I heard that Mari was going to play it. I'm not sure if that happened.
Oh, okay.
I know that Sara Christian just played it in early November with André de Ridder.
Yeah.
So she at least has played it, and I hope as many of my colleagues as possible, you know, pick
it
up.
Do they approach you then if they are getting the assignment now? It's Bryce's time.
I spoke with Sara Christian. Mm-hmm. She's an old friend from Kammerphilharmonie. Mm-hmm. And we spoke about it, but there's very little I can tell someone of her level. You know, she has it figured out. I can just, you know, say thank you for playing this piece. I hope you have a great time. But I do hope that it becomes kind of repertoire for more and more people. And I think
mean,
it will.
Yeah, it pretty much looks like, you know, because, I mean, it's not that often that new pieces are being performed so often.
Yeah, yeah. We had a really good November just now with it. I think I played it in 4 or 5 different places within the space of 1 month. And of course, new conductors like André de Ridder are taking care of it and have it on their radar. Also, Bryce was very clever in the way that he made an arrangement of the piece for chamber orchestra. It's not a lot smaller, but slightly.
Because the original version is already kind of reduced, as you say.
Exactly.
Right? But then he could even reduce it more.
Yeah, there's a few less brass players, maybe one or two percussionists less. It sounds exactly the same.
Was basically that the version that you were doing the play conduct with?
I haven't play conducted it.
You haven't yet?
No.
Okay, because there's also, maybe this list is really needs some correction, because there's a list on his publisher's website, you know.
Yeah, and they sometimes don't.
Maybe they exaggerate and then they say, but it looks like you were conducting and playing it, and I was wondering, wow, this is no mean feat. I mean,
it could be possible. It just needs a little bit more rehearsal time.
Yeah.
Just, it's more like a sort of matter of logistics discussion than any kind of magic tricks from me. I think it would be mostly in the second movement people would have to agree where the impulses come from.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't be me the whole time. Sometimes it would be a percussion player, sometimes a string principal, sometimes the bassoon player or something. So they would just have to be a little bit of extra time to make that conversation happen.
But basically, that be a nice challenge to do? Because just the way you'd explain it, sounds like a very interactive way of working with an orchestra as a soloist.
I think so, yeah. I did it with the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra in November at the Opera House in Oslo, which is another great arts building, recent arts building. And we considered trying play direct, but we've got a violinist in the group, a guy called Per Christian Skalstad, who is an excellent conductor. And so he works a lot at the opera in Oslo as an opera and ballet conductor. It was too easy to have him do it, you know.
Sure.
And he's a member of the family. And so sometimes when the conductor is, you know, great maestro who does not maybe want to be a member of the family but wants to be maestro instead, then that would have a negative effect on a piece like this, I would say. But when the conductor is a person who is first and foremost concerned with being a good musician and being a good colleague rather than being maestro, then it works.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Are there many differences for you in your experience with the different conductors conducting this piece? Do they have a very different approach to the Bryce, or do they rely on you and on your tempos and your input because it was written for you, you've premiered it, you've played it so often?
Yeah, so Esa-Pekka is, I think, sort of like the number one person for this. He's the person who's conducted it the most.
Okay, yeah.
And he has a kind of like a personal investment in Bryce's music, and he cares very much about Bryce and how his music is developing. It's kind of like family cooking in a way. Ariane Matiak, who conducted the premiere, was brilliant. And my only regret is that we haven't done it together since then. Mm-hmm. That was in Frankfurt with Hessischer Rundfunk. I just saw her recently because she was conducting the Mikael Karlsson Fanny and Alexander opera in Brussels that just concluded its first run.
Cool.
And I was very, very impressed by the piece and also by her because it...
Going back to the Ingmar Bergman
exactly, movie. Exactly. Wow. And the piece had a massive electronic component, the orchestra being manipulated live by a team of electronic musicians and the composer himself. And Ariane was just absolutely in charge of everything. So I look forward to one of these years getting to work, maybe on this piece or something else with her. Santtu Rouvali is an improviser, and his orchestra, Philharmonia, it's a collegium of improvisers.
Cool.
So the process is very different. Santtu and the orchestra play this piece like it's rock music. So things...
Because as I said, he comes from the drums, so he has the super percussive approach to...
Exactly, and he's this kind of conductor that you can see a kilometer away what he's doing and what he's going to do. It's absolutely fantastic. And everyone reacts so quickly when he's on board. In Frankfurt, we rehearsed, I think, 4 or 5 days for the premiere. 2 weeks later in London, we rehearsed 1 hour and 15 minutes.
Because it was still all there.
Yeah, well, it was a completely different orchestra, different conductor.
That's what you were saying.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. Okay. Wow. So with Santtu and Philharmonia, what Bryce said when he gave me the part, he said that you have to treat it like you wrote it. So he wants the performer to take that kind of freedom with it. And I pretty much play what he wrote, but just him saying that is a very liberating thing.
I totally can believe this, yeah.
Sometimes it's a very difficult thing to put into the orchestra materials because we are, after all, educated to play what's written.
To serve the score.
Exactly. Yeah. And when you have 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 musicians, it's very difficult to define what it means to play it like you wrote it. Especially if you're a member of the section, if everyone does a different thing, it might become a mess.
Yeah.
But I think what he's looking for is the energy of sort of like a Kronos quartet, that you deliver a score and then they sort of treat it kind of like a punk rock band. That they immediately find the gesture and then they do something, they kind of make it their own in mm-hmm. the best possible way. And that's kind of what Bryce is looking for. And in a way, when you have a long rehearsal period, you can engineer a lot of things and it results in really beautiful things happening. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, sometimes when you have an hour and 15 on a piece like this and somebody like Santtu and Philharmonia, it results in, you know, like if you go to a chamber music festival where there is a Schubert quintet that has been rehearsed for 35 minutes, it's like half the duration of the piece or something. Sometimes it becomes a sort of miracle of communication.
And of excitement.
Exactly. Things happen that could not be rehearsed.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes it's not so great. But when it clicks, it's wonderful. And this piece definitely gives the opportunity for that happening.
Yeah. Bryce has written another piece for you earlier, I think in 2015 or so, right?
The Ornaments and Crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's kind of an ongoing thing in a funny way, because since he wrote two movements for me and then there's been two more, we made a recording of three of the movements last year. Hmm. I don't know where it's going to end or if it's going to end.
Oh.
But it's a lovely piece. It's a much more, particularly the third movement of it, is much more lyrical and sort of more Philip Glass related, mm-hmm. American minimalism related music than what you find in the concerto. But it's still very much Bryce. He came to my little festival. I used to have one in Finland. And he, I think, sort of half accidentally wrote this cello piece called Tuusula, which was the name of the village next to where the festival happened. And so Nikola Altstedt was there that year, and so he premiered it, and I think he's been playing it in various places since. And again, this was a time when Bryce and when the National, for example, weren't such a massive band yet. that Bryce could sit in peace in the garage of a friend of mine playing his guitar. And people would stop by and listen, and there would be like 20, 30 people. And, oh, this is nice, somebody's playing guitar.
Not knowing who he was.
I think now if he would show up, there would be a flood of fans screaming for autographs.
But sweetly enough, he has maintained this gentillesse towards people, you know, yeah. And this openness and willingness to communicate and to share what he's doing. And
yeah.
That's very sweet.
Yeah, I think his constitution is a very noble one. Like he's not going to become an impossible diva.
No, it's too late for that. And yeah. It's not written in his charts, I would say.
Yeah, not in the DNA.
No. He explains a bit about the piece as being there's some resemblance to pilgrimage and to, you know, the Santiago de Compostela, where he lives now in the Pyrenees. And the water and these energies. Do you ever spare a thought for this meta levels of his concerto?
Yeah. Actually, he lives on the French side of Basque country. So like the other angle, other corner.
But it's already Pyrenees, right? I think it's quite up in the mountains already.
Hilly. Yeah. Near Biarritz. Yeah. It's actually a good thing because a lot of the piece, as you know, is very notey. There's a lot of things that needs to happen, and the thought of, he speaks a lot about waves and of the ocean, so sparing a little thought to that is a good shortcut to being able to zoom out a little bit from all the separate
all the
notes.
Details that,
yeah,
super, yeah,
exactly. So you just kind of allow them to happen, but try to keep your eye on the horizon in a way.
And then you coming from Finland, and the water is, I mean, like...
Yeah, the waves are smaller, but they are there. No, but it's also for the orchestra members, because I think the way the piece looks on paper, I think any orchestra musician in their right mind will be quite terrified of it when they see the material. And then there's usually a big sigh of relief in the rehearsal when you play it the first time, because people will understand, okay, so this is how it works.
Yeah.
And then... you can talk a little bit about the waves and the kind of the larger vista of the piece, and then things settle down and people can breathe a little bit more freely.
So then it kind of becomes a little more organic or
exactly
like nature and...
Yeah. When I was in driving school in Finland ages ago, my teacher said that all the young drivers, where they drive, they look at the first meter of the road in front of the car. And then after a couple of years, you are able to look kind of past a couple of intersections. That's sort of what you need to have happen in the space of one rehearsal.
Which has to happen with the vision, you know, just the scope needs to be.
Don't bury yourself in the music stand staring at the next measure. Just try to look at the whole page. And
yeah, that's good advice.
And sail.
You have been composing yourself, and I wonder how are you progressing in this?
As of late, I've been a songwriter. I have a band with a friend of mine called Gabriel Kahane, and the band is called Council, and we've been sort of Lennon McCartneying our way through an album.
I must say, I have heard this one piece that's available right now on Spotify.
Bright Forms, right?
It's a wonderful song. It's totally unusual, and it's very intimate, wonderfully sung. Your violin is very delicate, and the chords and the harmonies are like out of this world in a way.
Yeah,
and I wonder, is this you composing, or is this just a joint venture, a joint effort of how do we go from here to there?
It's a joint venture. We try to be in the room, both of us, whenever a song gets created. So you influence each other all the time. We had, I know what you mean. The chorus in that song does a very specific funny thing that kind of puts you in a different atmosphere. We had three songwriting weeks. Gabe came to North Karelia in Finland, the summer of last year, July of 23. This is where my in-laws live, where my wife comes from. And it's basically just lakes and forest and lots
of
silence.
It's way up in the north and close to the Russian border?
Close to the Russian border. It's not that far north.
Not that far. Yeah.
It's about 4 hours from Helsinki by car. And then we had another one in January. Gabe came back to Finland and we spent a week in the cold. And that's when we recorded this one song just as an experiment. And then between those, I went to Portland, Oregon, where he lives with his family, and we spent a week there. Now, June of this ending year, we spent a week at the Greenhouse Studio in Reykjavik, recording half an album. And just now, before Christmas, we spent a week at Flora Recording and Playback in Portland, Oregon, recording the other half of the album.
So the recording is done. It's really...
Well, I think some of the lead vocals we want to do in a sort of separate time.
Mm-hmm.
But basically we have too many songs, which is a nice thing. So we try to maybe assemble an EP for 25 and then the album when the time is right. But it's been a wonderful thing because Gabe is such an accomplished, not only songwriter and performer, but he's also a symphonic composer and a composer of chamber music. He's written for a lot of friends of mine, like Brooklyn Rider mm-hmm. Quartet and The Knights. And I think he's creative chair at Oregon Symphony at the moment. He writes symphony music that has something to do with the world today.
Good.
And that's not entirely common.
Yeah.
And so I've been learning tons from him. Before that happened, so I had a brother who sadly passed away a couple of years ago.
Jaakko.
Jaakko, double vowel, Jaakko. Double consonant.
Yeah.
And Osmo Vänskä had commissioned a symphony from him for Minnesota Orchestra for, I think, June of 22. And so he passed away in February of 22, and the symphony was, there were about 10 minutes of it in two movements, and the commission was for 25 minutes. And all the things that we found from him, all the notes, all the sketches, they were already composed into the 10 minutes that existed.
Okay.
It was 10 minutes of finished score, but just in two parts with no advice on how to link them and no advice on how the piece ends.
Mm-hmm.
So I became like an accidental symphonist. I finished the piece for him.
So you morphed into his way of musical thinking and tried to make sense of these pieces? And
yeah, I did what I could. And then there was a great guy from the Fenica German.
What's Fenica German?
Fenica German is a music publishing company.
Oh, okay.
There's a traditional Swedish one called Germans Musikförlag,
mm-hmm.
Germans Music Publishing. And they bought kind of the Finnish national music publisher. And that became then
so
Fenica German.
Yeah.
And the guy who used to run that company was my brother's editor.
Okay.
So they had finished the orchestra scores that my brother had written before mm-hmm. Together. So I would sit at home and write piano score and make markings, maybe horns, maybe trombones, maybe clarinets, maybe violas, that kind of things. And then we would sit down and look at my brother's opera scores and orchestral scores and try to find the right way of orchestrating.
How he would have done it,
yeah.
And how he did it in the past.
And he's basically been following, my brother's been following Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov since the age of 8. so he read the orchestration manual then. So it's a very clear logic and a kind of clear sound world. So I did that. And before that, there was an animated TV series about the Moomin Trolls.
Legendary.
Yeah.
Figure in the Finnish pop culture, one could even say, right?
Yeah, and yeah. It's funny because it's partly for children, but the books are mostly for adults.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So a production company made a new animated series about them, and I wrote the music for the first season together with a friend of mine. And sadly, I don't have an education for composing for symphony orchestra, so I wouldn't call myself a composer in that sense, but I do things for my friends. Basically.
Which is a wonderful way of applying what you know and...
Yeah. And in a way that a hobby becomes a part of the profession.
Yeah.
Which keeps the profession fresh.
How does Gabriel Kahain come in this picture? I mean, you speak of him as if he was like very close to you, also as a person, and you seem to click in a way that's not so often happening. If you say Lennon McCartney-ish and...
Yeah. I mean, he's a very dear friend. We've known each other for a bunch of years already, and I've guested in his solo concerts a number of times. And then at some point, I think what I was doing in his songs started to become maybe a bit more compositional than improvisational.
Mm-hmm.
And then the idea came up that we should do something where we kind of 50-50 share the responsibilities for everything. So Gabe's dad is Jeffrey Kane, who's a brilliant pianist and conductor.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gabe has his knowledge of the classical tradition, classical music, and how classical music works on the side of, like, the business of it, the logistics of classical music. He knows it just as well
inside
as anyone
mm-hmm.
I know. So it's, he knows exactly how kind of my life clicks. And I think secretly I've always been wanting to have more to do with the side of music where things happen in song format and the side of music where instrumentations and arrangements are decided based on what's available and not based on kind of like a traditional format. So when we make music together, we listen to the song and then start to think about how do we dress this up? And there's no... Sometimes it's verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, that kind of thing. Sometimes it's something completely different. And it's a very refreshing place to explore with somebody who's done so much thinking about it already. It's really a part of his everyday life to try to reinvent this thing. Plus, he's a concerned citizen. He's very actively following what goes on in American politics and international politics. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of try to console each other whenever something goes horribly wrong again. Yeah. So it's kind of like, he reminds me very much of another mutual friend of ours, Jonathan Biss, the mm-hmm. pianist. And kind of, I think Jonathan's parents, Miriam Fried and Paul Biss, were my teachers back in the day.
Yeah.
And they were great friends of Gabe's dad and this kind
of... So there's a connection going even in the...
Yeah, and there's a feeling of like me also not losing the connection to this American musical family that I had when I was studying there,
mm-hmm.
which is a kind of like a heartwarming thing. And also like the fun thing is that if I compare what I'm doing now and what my friends are doing now to what I saw maybe 20 years ago when I was more like at the beginning of what I'm doing, everything feels so much more free now. And I don't think it's just in my head, but something about the profession, maybe it's the uncertainty that we, most of us have in the profession that makes us think a little bit more.
Liberates people more in unconventional thinking and
exactly
improvising more.
Yeah, like because there's fewer and fewer guarantees on anything, then, you know, it's a very stressful way to find liberation, but it is a way to find liberation when suddenly you feel like playing this kind of thing is not going to be possible anymore. It's not relevant anymore. You maybe feel that I don't want to play another violin concerto that tells the story of a chosen one. Like the world doesn't need any more chosen ones. Let's do something else. But I was educated to be the chosen one in the Sibelius concerto or whatever. So it's a
paradigm shift also in your own, the way you perceive your role within the world you inhabit, you know.
Exactly. And then in the meantime, so many things about the profession push you towards thinking about yourself. You know, it's so easy to get caught up in thinking about, oh, what do I need to be? What should I be? What do people expect of me?
Yeah.
So to get to do things like I mentioned with Gabe Kahane or other friends, it's basically surrounding yourself with people who are better at what you're trying to do than you are. I'm conducting quite a lot these days. And then I have this concert where Esa-Pekka Salonen is conducting. Holy shit.
Yeah.
It is incredible. Because you realize at the same time how wonderful and how meaningful it can be to wave your hands at an orchestra. And then at the same time you realize how much work there is left to do.
Yeah.
And that's, it's slightly painful, but it's a wonderful feeling.
Is he every now and then mentoring you a little on conducting, or do you never touch that subject with him?
I've spoken to him about it. I think the first time I ever tried it in a master course, he was actually there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was terrifying because my job was to conduct Dumbarton Oaks, the chamber concerto by Stravinsky. And I don't think it's anyone's choice of conducting that when somebody like Esa-Pekka is in the audience.
Watching you.
Yeah. But he's just such a nice guy. Like there's none of this kind of awkward I don't sort of go to him as a fanboy asking him, can you show me your third beat? This kind of thing. But it's just, he radiates this kind of open thing, and he doesn't take himself seriously.
Oh, great.
And that's I think, what makes a big part of what makes him so popular with the great orchestras. He's just... It's a normal person who's just extremely capable of navigating through this.
Still radiating this beautiful authority and knowingness about what he's doing, you know, and what he wants to hear.
And it's not authority first.
Yeah.
It's communication and music, and not like
would
I'm the boss.
Would you say that there is a specific Finnish quality also in the term of getting along with each other under musicians from your country? Because it's obvious that there are so many brilliant conductors coming out of Finland, so many brilliant soloists and musicians, and out of a population that's not so massive, you know, in terms of numbers.
Yeah, I would... Like, it's a lucky set of accidents, like, that we had Sibelius and his music became so popular, and that we have, for example, a conductor educating program since a long time ago.
Which must be extremely efficient, because you're producing conductor after conductor who is conquering the world stages.
It is extremely efficient. And one of the parts, I think, of it is, you know, that you have a live orchestra present in every lesson, and then you go through... the tricky moments in the repertoire, including how to navigate a Sibelius symphony. Because we kind of grow up knowing instinctively how they sound because you hear them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a part of the ABC. But it's not like that all over the world. Orchestras still want to play them. Audiences want to hear them. And then you get somebody, they might be like an 18-year-old person from Finland who already knows what the tricky moments are. And it's such a good entrance. It's like a way into the profession.
Yeah, that counts for Sibelius, but maybe then there are some other composers where there is an even knowledge of the thing. I think one of the reasons, I think it was Klaus Mäkelä who told me that even for the rehearsals, the student orchestra gets paid in Finland. So that means there's intrinsic motivation to really show up and to be there and to really take it seriously.
Yeah,
and to feel treated respectfully as a musician.
When I was a student at Sibelius Academy, like a violin student, I wasn't ever an official member of the conducting class orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we would all go out and party a little bit on Friday nights, and the conducting class exercises would be on Saturday morning. So sometimes in the bar, somebody would realize, oh my God, I'm having a really good night tonight. I really don't want to be in the conducting class orchestra tomorrow at 10. Could you go for me? You can keep the money.
And you were still less drunk than him.
So. Yeah, usually. And I was already playing Sibelius concertos. So I sometimes did go, and I realized what an efficient system it is. And then I think after the lessons with the orchestra, the conducting class goes to the studio and watches the video recordings of everyone's lessons and discusses what could be
mutually also.
Exactly. And I think when it works the best, the class becomes a sort of family. So they do support each other, because everyone's, of course, very insecure in the beginning and usually well into the profession as well. But as for like general behavior in front of orchestras, I don't think there's any special quality in a Finnish person. I think we are just as likely to be frustrated and sometimes nasty to colleagues as other people. I've heard now that the Sibelius Academy is, they host the conducting class. That's a part of the Sibelius Academy. They are now considering building a component into the conducting education that would be about what power does to people, what power will do to you when you eventually become a conductor. Wow. And this is brilliant, because I think it's happened so many times, and it still keeps happening, that few years into the profession, you suddenly wake up, you realize you're maestro, and that everything, this belongs to you. You've earned this 5-star hotel, and you've earned the first class plane ticket. And it's not like that, and it will mess up your head. So this kind of education, when you think you are next to God, what do you then do to
do you have anyone specific in mind talking about these people? Also coming from Finland, or
there's a pretty strong tradition in people with power in any profession.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
There's a mechanism to it, a much more dire or horrifying example of it. I was watching the film Spotlight from maybe about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's an American film that discusses the journalistic team called Spotlight, who are the investigative journalists at the Boston Globe newspaper. And the film focuses on the year 2000, 2001, 2002, when the first kind of really big articles about the Catholic Church started arriving. And so Spotlight kind of, in a way, started that
researched
that snowball rolling. Yeah. And in the film, there's a kind of interview with a researcher who exists also in reality, a gentleman called Richard Sipe, mm-hmm. who had spent a lot of time. He was a Catholic priest. And then the church had, I think, hired him to figure out why these things keep happening, why the priests sometimes go crazy and start misbehaving towards the children, mm-hmm. especially in the church. And he came up with a prediction that when you're celibate and when everyone thinks that you are next to God, this is the percentage that the priests will then become pedophiles in that case.
So the likeliness, and of course the fact that they're not allowed to have a sex life.
Exactly. So the pressures are of that, and then the fact that everyone treats you like you're God's right hand, and then that you have the total secrecy with the kids, and the kids think you are God's best friend. So the I can't remember the exact name of priests in Boston. I think it might have been 1,400. Richard Sipe's research predicted something like 95 of them would be pedophiles. And in the end, the journalists found evidence of, I think, 93 or 96. So the prediction was incredibly accurate. And I think it's like a just a completely quantifiable psychological phenomenon. This is absolute power, and this is what it will do to you. And it's not, of course, it's not that with conductors, but the mechanism. Or you see Elon Musk in the news, you see Mr. Trump. These are extreme examples, but when you surround yourself with people who are only fans and who want to share of the pie, this is what it'll do to you. A couple of years ago, I was actually, so this is a very, very long story now, but there was this wonderful pop music talent in Sweden, a guy called Avicii. Mm-hmm. He was like the king of EDM for so many years.
He died with 25 years or so.
No, I think actually 27.
The legendary
27. And I was, because his career completely ran him into the ground. Mm-hmm. Like he was so overexposed for so many years. And the people running his career just wanted more and more and more. And he thought he needed more and more and more. There's a documentary film about him when he was still alive, and you can see
the how pressure.
he starts to realize that this is not going to end well. And he did get out of touring, but it was too late for him to mend completely. So in the end, he did take his own life. And I couldn't stop wondering, like, this is Sweden. This is the country that produces pop stars and pop music for the whole world. How come they haven't built a mechanism to protect
to prevent this kind of happening. Yeah.
And now when I heard this thing about the conducting class starting to educate their students about the effects of power on people, I thought, bravo, this is exactly what we need. Like, we don't need any more gifted young musicians, conductors, thinking that they need to get everything by the time they're like 23 or something. It's just not, you know, if you're... Think about Tarmo Peltokoski, for example, who's a wonderful conductor. If he's going to do a Herbert Blomstedt, he has like 75 years of conducting left.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I remember and I recognize the feeling that you have to try to do everything now. But I hope that generation by generation, we will also evolve in the sense that you'll understand that there is time. And even if there isn't time, if you have a short life, that's also fine. There's no... Just don't ruin the artistic impulses you have for the sake of trying to do everything at the same time.
Yeah. You have been quite wise with speaking about age and the little time one has on Earth. And way, way back 15 years ago or so, I saw a video of yours where you speak about this. And I was wondering to what extent your life has been... I'm short of the right verb, influenced, of course, or devastated, all kinds of things, by the passing of your brother when he was still so young. And you were, I mean, you are way before 50. So is there another sense of preciousness of life that has not been there before? Or is this just...
Yeah, I suppose. So it's still like only about 2.5 years ago, which is a good amount of time, but it was a crazy time because he was ill for about 1.5 years. He had this brain tumor.
He was conducting here in this hall when he was already having his diagnosis.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. With Kammerphilharmonie.
Yeah.
And in a way he got, like, it's the most unlucky thing. There's no cure for it.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way he, in the unluckiness, he got lucky because he didn't have any physical symptoms. And for most people, this particular disease already starts with epilepsy and very strong seizures. So you kind of sometimes lose the ability to function.
So the only thing that he had was headaches, and then
he had a little bit of headache in the beginning, and a little bit
speech impediments. That was
very small, yeah. And I think because he had a boat that he knew and loved very well, a sort of a boat that you could live in, and suddenly he would bump his head or bump his shoulder into this boat that he knew inside out. So the perception of space became somehow.
Oh.
But that was only in the beginning. And then he had surgery and he had all kinds of treatments. And they could see how the tumors grow back and multiply. But the only sort of real noticeable symptoms after that was just the last 2 months before he died. He forgot everything.
Mm.
He thought he was at a music festival, and he thought he was, you know, on tour with friends, and then he just kind of became more and more tired. It wasn't like
it wasn't an agony of such a long time.
Exactly, and there was no pain, and then one day he was gone. But the tricky thing was that my mom got very ill at the same time, and then she died about 1.5 months after my brother. And I think that sort of kind of
pulled the carpet away. Must have been very horrifying.
Yeah, it took a long time. And the weird thing is my father is still alive. He's 91 and he has had Alzheimer for many years. And he used to support himself by playing jazz in restaurants in the 50s and 60s. So he never thought he would live longer than 75.
Well, and now he keeps
and
going. Now,
and his plan was always to die first. And then me and my brother and my mom would have all this time to do stupid things without having to worry about him and his memory. And now he's in a care facility in Helsinki, and I go to see him whenever I can. And when he remembers who he is and where he is, I think still a few months ago he said, like, you know, this wasn't the way I planned it. So it's,
Does he still recognize you?
Yeah, primarily by sound.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he has fantastic...
Sound of your voice? Are you playing for him sometimes?
We play for him often, and there's a piano in his room. And you know, my sister is married to Iiro Rantala, the jazz pianist, so they go there often, and Iiro always plays for him, and my dad enjoys it tremendously. He's always loved Iiro's playing. But it is... I did find myself going to... like Joan Didion books about her husband passing away and her daughter passing away. There was a very brave thing by the CNN news journalist Anderson Cooper. When his mom died a couple of years ago, he made a podcast series that I think still continues, where he interviews people about this kind of things. And it's one of those cliches or stereotypes that become true, that this kind of things really do help. And one thing that was also kind of like a happy accident is that I have a great friend who's a photographer and researcher, somebody called Maija Tammi.
Mm-hmm.
And one of her big photographic projects was to take pictures of people receiving cancer treatments, and particularly brain tumor treatments, the kind of plastic masks that you wear that focus the treatment in the right place or kind of hold your head in place. And she would take pictures of crematoriums, being operating, and she would take pictures of things that have been cut out from people, like toes because of diabetes, kidney stones, breast cancer tumors. We made concerts together where I would play, for example, Violin Face by Steve Reich, and in the background there would be a film of a breast cancer surgery spinning backwards that she made. And one of her things is that she gently forces people to look at things that you don't want to be looking at.
Whoa.
And in a way, it feels quite horrible in the moment. Afterwards, you can breathe a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is very much the case with both my mom and my brother's illnesses, because I had been kind of, for artistic reasons, forcing myself to look at pictures of people having cancer treatments. Then it was not a foreign, it was not like a spaceship to me. It was something that I had been looking at.
You had been a little familiar with already.
Yeah. And then it sort of allows you to become a little bit fascinated with how stupid the disease is, how kind of unevolved a cancer is, because it kills itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it shouldn't kill the host.
Yeah.
It should remain stable, survive, and kind of thrive, yeah. But don't kill the host. That cancer hasn't evolved to understand that yet. And there's another friend of mine, somebody called Suvi Savola, who works in a hospital or in a cancer research center in Amsterdam. And she's kind of trying to figure out the start switches of different cancers, what makes them tick.
Go on, yeah.
And she, we would do concerts where she would give a lecture in three or four parts between my pieces that I would play. And then I would accompany my music with Maija Tammi's photographs or films. It would be Bach Chaconne for mutation, or Steve Reich for slow mutation. There was a piece written for me by Perttu Haapanen that had a lot of spoken text that had to do with cancer diagnosis in Finnish. Very aggressive kind of piece. And I know that these concerts were not easy for the audience members, but it really, really felt like it opened up the door to not only be afraid, but also to be a little bit fascinated about.
So an artistic approach to the memento mori kind
exactly.
of concept.
And one of the really valuable things that my researcher friend from Amsterdam, Suvi, always points out, that some of these diseases you can affect your chances by lifestyle choices. Like you can not smoke 10 packs a day. You can not lie in the sun for 10 hours a day. But still, the first and foremost reason for this disease is bad luck.
Mm-hmm.
And with this kind of like brain tumors or tumors in the esophagus like my mom had, there's like, it's bad luck.
There's pretty much no way to,
yeah.
to get cured.
And in a way, like, or the reason it starts is just you're unlucky. And in a way, that's kind of horrible news. But in a way, it's also, in a strange way, kind of liberating.
Yeah.
Because it's not a fight, you know. Sometimes when people get cancers, people talk about it, or newspapers write about it as a battle. And it's extremely unfair to those who have a form of the disease where a battle is not possible, because it makes you feel like you're a loser.
Powerlessness.
Like, you're failing because you're not able to fight. It's a terrible responsibility to give to someone.
Is your brother's boat still there?
He sold it. Widow sold it. I know where it lives.
Good.
And I know the person who has it. It was a fun one because when my brother was a teenager, my dad used to sail big boats when he was younger. And so we always had some kind of a little boat when we grew up. And my brother was particularly fascinated with this one maker of boats that came from close to our home. And so when he was 16, he was entering the Sibelius competition. And my dad, as a joke, said to him, like, if you get to the finals, I'm going to buy that boat. And it was, back then, it was a terribly expensive boat. And my dad, of course, couldn't afford it. But he didn't think that my brother
would make it.
He made it.
I know.
so my dad was in trouble. My brother forgave him eventually. But about 10 years ago, he bought that exact same boat, like secondhand, so it was affordable. And he had been sort of waiting for it for like 25 years.
Oh, sweet. That's a sweet story.
Yeah, it was great.
And did they go on a sail together then?
Your father yeah,
and
yeah,
yeah, yeah. Oftentimes.
Yeah, and then we, you know, we all rode the boat many times, and it was kind of like he actually even like for the last couple of summers of his life, during the Savonlinna Opera Festival, he took a couple of weeks off of work and became a sightseeing boat.
I read about that. Yeah, and boat he would captain. Do the shuttle and for people to go there.
Exactly, they would like take people out to the lake for 2 hours and give them champagne and strawberries and yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah. It was like turning the hobby into the profession.
Yeah. Becca, it was absolutely wonderful talking to you. And I could go
Thank
on for
you.
Quite a while, but I think we should call it a day and give you some off time now before you go on stage, because it's an early concert even. It starts at 6, so...
Yeah, exactly. I go to Oslo next week to work with the chamber orchestra and different repertoire, so I need to do a little bit of studying.
Yeah.
Actually, my brother's cello concerto.
Oh.
Yeah. I haven't...
You are conducting it then?
I'm play directing it. It's strings and percussion and cello, so it's doable. I'm mostly...
So you're on the first chair in the, of the violins and conductor from there.
Stehgeiger. Yeah, but I try to... I perform very little of his music because there's a strange vibe to it. And I want mostly other people to do it.
Yeah.
I don't want people to think that I'm doing... That his music is being performed because I'm his brother and I'm choosing to mm-hmm. sort of posthumously help him in that way. But this time the cello soloist is like the little brother of my brother's first wife, somebody that we knew for like 30 years.
So
and
it had to be.
It needs to happen. And we have a beer and a sauna and it's going to be fun. It's going to be nice.
I wish you good luck with that and for everything else.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks for having me.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.